I'm Duncan MacLeod, and you're joining us for episode 3 of Everything PC, a new podcast from Tech Central, where we delve into everything that's happening in the PC industry worldwide, looking at some of the history, some of the big players in the space. And in season 1 specifically, we're having a look at the semiconductor companies and their fortunes and mishaps over the last little while, and where things are going. And in this collaboration, this Everything PC podcast, my co-collaborator is Gerard Pretorius, and he joins me now. Gerard, it's good to see you again. How are you doing?
Yes, exciting as always.
Excellent. Well, first two episodes, in case you missed them, we do recommend you go back and listen to those, because we are kind of doing this as a series, and we're going to talk a lot of this, of course, is interrelated, and certainly the subject of our first four episodes are two companies that are very interrelated, Intel and AMD. We covered AMD in quite a lot of detail in episodes 1 and 2, and episodes 3 and 4, we are going to take a deep dive into the Intel Corporation, which is often referred to as Chipzilla, one of the big, if not the biggest player, certainly historically the biggest player in the semiconductor industry. I think it could be probably disputed now about who really is the biggest player in the semiconductor market, but a big important company that's kind of lost its way a little bit in the last few years, and we're gonna delve into some of that detail and look at what's happened with the company, why it's had some strategic blunders in recent years, and whether its new CEO Pat Gelsinger is the right man to turn it around. We're going to deal a lot with that, sort of the current and future looking stuff for Intel in episode 2. But we're going to start today with having a look at the history of Intel, where it's come from, its role in the semiconductor industry, its role in the PC industry, and really how it's actually changed, how it is one of the fundamental players in IT. Started all the way back, Gerard, in 1968, founded by Gordon Moore, of course, of Moore's Law fame, and his colleague Robert Noyce. And Gordon Moore is a chemist, of all things, and Robert Noyce is a physicist and co-inventor of the integrated circuit. And they started a company called NM Electronics back in 1968, which would very soon be renamed Intel Corporation. And a couple of years after that, they launched the first commercially available microprocessor. And that, if you don't know, is the Intel 4004. That was launched in 1971. And after that, they've really gone on, Gerard, to reshape or define the PC industry and the microprocessor industry.
Yeah.
And effectively invented it.
Well, they basically, I would say, inventing is a bit
it's
too much credit for them, but right. They certainly found a niche and went for it. So
yes.
That's just, now we're going back to the old IBM days, where yeah. IBM's main failure there was they didn't really, their focus was too much on the data center and not consumer.
Yeah.
Where Intel then made a consumer chip that they could mass produce at a fairly decent scale in those times. In those times, compared to what they made, the amount of chips they made then till now is, yeah, it's a joke. Like your modern day Chinese company that makes a toy makes more processor than what Intel did in the beginning.
But it was groundbreaking stuff, that Intel 4004 chip.
So their main attribute there was manufacturing. So this is one thing I should maybe start with Intel. Intel predominantly, first and foremost, was a manufacturing company.
Yeah.
They are good at manufacturing chips, and you can still see that today. They are still regarded as one of the biggest guys that make chips. They ship the most amount of chips out.
Massive company. There's the 4004 that they produced in 1971. Looks nothing like microprocessors you'd know today, of course. I mean, look at those. Those arms that's sitting on top of there that would then connect to, what would that connect to in 71? Some sort of early motherboard?
Yeah, no, it's all early motherboards. You can either get, well, it's either a socket. In those days, it was all just soldered straight to the boards and so forth. Now you'll see, if you look at some of the websites that do like retro fixes and so forth, they'll actually have like a small little plastic thing with holes in it that you can have socket the CPU in and take it out, in and out now the whole time.
Right. Right.
But yeah, in those days it was just literally like, just have that amount of holes, put it through, solder it out, done.
Yeah.
From that chip, we then lead to the, as we discussed in the AMB show, the Clone Wars, where everybody made copies of those type of chips from Intel. Then AMD, when was that? Well, basically AMD get access to x86 as that matured from that architecture, so that because I think that was one of the mandates from IBM, that IBM told Intel that there has to be a second source for chips because we can't just rely on Intel.
I was wondering how that started, because I was actually reading an article on this before the show, and I saw that they've got this sort of never-ending IP sharing agreement where they're allowed to cross-share or cross-license the technologies they develop, and it's in perpetuity. So the IBM was the origin.
Yes, IBM was the guy that mandated Intel, where it's like, no, if we're going to buy chips from Intel, we need to have a second source, because if you die, what happens then? We're screwed. Okay. Or maybe you get attacked, or maybe there's a design flaw.
Fascinating.
Don't put all your chickens in, or all your eggs in one basket, because if it fails, it can catastrophically fail. And again, that's now a testament to IBM's we scale for data centers.
And there are only two ways that agreement can be cancelled. Did you know this?
Yes.
Either AMD goes bankrupt.
Yeah.
Or someone acquires them, or the controlling shareholder changes in AMD.
Yes.
If one of those two happens, Intel's entitled to
I assume from now onwards they can probably battle that a bit more, but I think Intel is like, that's why you could. Intel has no desire for AMD to fail, even when AMD was at their lowest point, because they want AMD, they want someone there that's complacent and weak, that can't catch up to them, so that they have monopoly.
Yes.
So
yes, and of course AMD is catching up to them, but
that kind of like. Completely, you can, in retrospect, you can say that kind of bite Intel in the ass. Hardcore that they left AMD. No, AMD will never be able to match us, blah, blah, blah. And then, kapoof, 20 years later, oopsie.
But we're going to deal with that. In fact, we've dealt with how well AMD is doing in our previous podcasts. But we're going to have a look at how Intel under Pat Gelsinger is responding to that challenge. But we are going to deal with that mostly, as I say, in episode 4, part 2 of this episode. But just going back to some of the history. So they introduced the 4004 in 1971. Of course, a lot of water under the bridge over the next 10 years or so as the company developed and expanded into new product areas. Yeah. But it was in the 1980s that they really started to become a big dominant company, where they started to develop the chips that were used in both IBM and IBM compatible clone PCs. And people old enough like you and me will remember these chips, like the 8086 and the 286 and the 386 and the 486, and the various sub chips, if I could call it.
Iterations that they've made, because some of those are improvements of others, and then you had them. Well, I think what's it? Going deep into the Clone Wars. So we had Motorola making chips. We had Toshiba making chips. We've got AMD making chips. We've got Intel making chips. You've got all the old, most of those old companies, old dead. So there's IBM PCs. We had Sinclair there. We've had, what's the other company now? The name escapes me.
Commodore.
What's the other one? Amiga. That's now where all those people would buy from Intel, from AMD, from Motorola, all those chips. And that's now when the PC war started. And that's where you could see kind of, especially with Commodore coming in and so forth and Amiga, IBM struggled to really get the ball rolling. And then they started with the old, the PC Junior that was kind of...
Yes.
And then iterations of that. But now through Intel selling all of those things, Intel learns how to... You can see how they started to see how they can... outposition themselves with other companies, because later on those years, as we get to the 90s, you can see how Intel cuts all those corners off so that they become like, we are the company that does everything. So they do it through either buying or suing them to say, you're using x86, you're not allowed to use x86 anymore. Yeah, so there's a lot of legal problems that happen in those time periods where Intel started to cut down to say, we need to make sure we make this niche, because if we don't, one of our competitors can overtake us and kill us, basically.
Right.
So they just went super aggressive and made sure.
It became extremely dominant in that period. I mean, AMD had some success in the late 1990s, but right through the 80s and the 1990s, PCs were synonymous with Intel and, of course, Microsoft on the software side with DOS and then Windows.
Yeah.
But when you went to buy a PC in the 80s and 90s, you were buying a PC with Intel
with inside. Intel, yeah. And it's basically because at that stage, very quickly, Intel made sure that they can out-manufacture all the other guys. They can out-manufacture AMD, they can out-manufacture Toshiba, they can out-manufacture Motorola, specifically so that they can set their dominance.
They spent spent a lot of money building fabrication plants
and to their credit,
across the world.
And to their credit, they pioneered. They out-manufactured a lot of those companies.
Mm.
So that's where we
were normally a pioneering smart company in those days.
Hence why Moore was a chemist. There's a lot of the stuff that has to do with chemistry, chemicals and all that type of jazz. And then you need a CPU designer and all those things. So to make a CPU, you need a lot of different fuels to actually communicate with one another and so forth. The thing that sets it apart is Intel, not too early, but you can start seeing closer on. They started to get people that was really good with management in terms of logistics and distribution. So getting parts where they need to go, at what time, getting those channels set in. Because again, a lot of those things had to be either was manufactured in America. But the thing is, you're not just selling a CPU to them. You have to sell all the other different things that go with it. Either in those days, they still had, co-processor. So you had a mathematical processor specifically, or this type of processor that accelerates these specific workloads. So you need to now make sure that you can, if it's now Dell or HP in the early days and so forth, communicate with these guys, manufacture the right amount of stock, get it delivered to where they need it in terms of where they need for manufacturing, what was either in America or in China and so forth. In the early days, most of those things were made in America, funny enough, like the Amigas and the Commodores. So, but it's still, you need to get a truck, manufacture it on time, get it on a truck, send it to them. They need to put it in. How do you help them to make it sure that the packaging is done? How to do the designs? Hence why we have the Intel ATX standards, which Intel still kind of is the seating position. So now we see this with the new ATX standards that's coming out for the new PCI Express 5 graphics card. Intel pioneered that field of ATX, how to make ATX a standard, where everybody has the same thing so that it's easier for Intel to kind of dominate, but it's also helping them in terms of, okay, now they don't have to figure out how to make power supplies and all that jazz. Intel's already done the work for us, so we could just copy it.
Yeah, yeah.
So Intel in those early days, again, to Intel's credit, they did a lot of work to do that, which is pioneering in that field. And it's not just power supplies. They did motherboard designs, what shape motherboards, even the ATX standard that we use for motherboards. Intel made that, and Intel standardized that we use today.
Mm.
So
it's the
good old days of very aggressive Intel being very pioneering.
I don't know how old you are, Gerard, but my formative years with computers was in the 1980s. It's when I was in school, and I went through all of these processor generations that Intel brought out. And every time we moved up from the 8086 to the, I think we had the 8088, which was a very similar chip, then to the 286, the 386, and the 486. Each time we moved to a new generation of Intel chip, there was a massive performance improvement. Not the sort of improvements you see between core generations today.
We're talking massive
improvements. And there was incredible innovation going on at the time.
Yeah, and most of that innovation and performance came from design. So manufacturing. Not specifically design, mainly in we can make the transistors more dense.
Mm-hmm.
So it's purely manufacturing lead. So even if Intel had, let's say if it was a proper competitor there, Intel would still have won because their chip, the actual manufacturing process, manufacturing method was more mature and more advanced than what all the other companies had.
Yeah, yeah. Were they using more advanced nodes than their competitors?
Kind of, but
what was the advantage they really had?
It's mainly just in terms of manufacturing to scale and then manufacturing in terms of quality control. So they had better yields. They could just out-manufacture that. So you can see it.
They could do it cheaper.
Cheaper as well, but it's also the quality. Like the Intel chips were more reliable. They lasted longer.
So you
can see later on where AMD started to get really aggressive, that kind of, you could see that competition there. But still then, I would say it's only really now that Intel's dominance, I would say about now, about 3 years ago, that Intel lost the dominance in CPU manufacturing. But
the 80s and 90s were definitely their strongest period.
Yes, now the manufacturing, they were just pioneers in
manufacturing. This was the era when Gordon Moore was CEO, and then, of course, Andy Grove took over, I think, in the late 80s, and he was CEO for about 10 years before he had, unfortunately, hit health troubles. Incredible pioneers in this industry. I mean, Moore was, of course, the name behind the famous Moore's Law, which we all know, and Andy Grove was an early employee. He wasn't one of the co-founders, but he was an early employee. He was a refugee, I think, from... the refugee from the Nazis, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, so well, that's now, you could say the old guard, but they were all engineers, so they knew what needed to be done. Because it was aggressive in those times. You couldn't just sit and sit in your chair and chill. You had to work for every inch. And they were also, to Moore's credit, they knew where the weaknesses were and targeted them deliberately to make sure that they will have a very proper future. And then also in that sense, they kind of wanted to go toe-to-toe to IBM. So when they can attack the mainframe and take over server is the big one.
Right, servers. Yeah.
Once you take
server. Client-server computing.
That's where the money sits, is server. You can ask any company. Server is where you make your stupid money.
Yeah, and that's about a third to about 40%, I think, of Intel's revenue today comes from... from data center.
It's difficult because the problem is that it's not just that. Because in data center and so forth, your advantage is also in terms of R&D that you don't really pay for. So because you're working with all of these companies, they give you feedback. And that feedback is worth millions. I'm not joking. When I tell people, it's like getting feedback from Dell and HP when they do their servers and they test their software on it, then Intel can go back in their design and change stuff and so forth to make it more proficient in there. So...
yeah,
that even that they make a stupid money from them, and then those people help them to make even more money in terms of that R&D cost. They don't have to actually go figure it out. They can just go, oh, these guys already kind of already found where we need to go, found the breadcrumbs, and then we need to just fix this and this and this, and then there you go, extra 5% or 10% more performance.
I'm trying to remember the exact timeline here, but we went 286, 386, 486, and then there was no 586. That became what was known as, and this is when Intel abandoned that old numbering scheme, and they introduced a chip called the Pentium.
Yes.
And this was also, if I recall correctly, around the time that Intel hit its first major crisis.
Kerfuffle,
because there was a major problem with the Pentium chip. It couldn't add numbers or something. What was the story there? Do you recall what happened?
As far as I know, it's to do with the actual mathematical processing in there. So how it does add, subtract, and multiply and so forth. That did it wrong. So when you give it a bunch of numbers and you tell it, do these all these instructions and so forth, it would add, and to its own mind, it says, no, but what I'm adding is correct, but it would actually add digits to it. And when you do that, people don't buy processors that give you different answers every time you ask it.
Yeah,
people
want
to buy a processor that gives you the same answer every time, no matter how many times you ask. So,
there we go. The Pentium FDIV, I think it's FD4 bug is a hardware bug affecting the floating point unit of the early Intel Pentium processors. Yeah. Because of the bug, the processor would return incorrect binary floating point results when dividing certain pairs of high precision numbers. And it was a massive, I remember this, it was in the headlines for months
This was a massive kerfuffle. It's like massive egg in the face. Because it's like, how did you miss this? And it's one of those things where it's like, probably with the chips they made somehow were not affected, and then when they mass produced it, there was some issue with mass production that completely reared its head. And yeah, that's why you spend a lot of money to design chips to make sure this doesn't happen, because this is a lot of money to go and literally make a new chip. Because if you dial HP or IBM, and though they, I don't know if IBM was really fluent in those days anymore, but Dell and HP, they would literally just send you the chip back and say, where's my new chip, thank you. You had to, you know, on your own cost, give them new CPUs and so forth. So luckily they could weather the storm with that one, because they've already by that time accumulated a lot of money, so they could absorb that as a, and then again they probably have insurance for that type of disasters or whatever.
That was an interesting time.
That was one of the first major kerfuffles they had with design, and then we get to NetBurst, which is another moment for them. And then
NetBurst, I don't remember that one. What happened there?
That was their different architecture, where they tried to do a clustered architecture. So that was basically, I don't think they really released that from what I remember. But basically, instead of having what we now have, one core, two core, three core, it's basically, imagine you would try and make a GPU a CPU.
Yeah.
With hyper-parallelization. And that failed miserably, because, first of all, GPUs weren't really a massive thing by then. So people didn't really know how to program for 100 cores or 50 cores or anything like that. It was just like, blah, blah, what the hell? And then that whole architecture, in principle, was very nice. But it only worked on a piece of paper. It didn't actually work in real life. And that failed miserably. And NetBurst also then led to... NetBurst? What did NetBurst lead to? NetBurst led to... I think basically after that, they had Pentium, NetBurst. NetBurst was a fail. Titanium. And then the core processor started. And that's...
Oh, the Itanium. That was their development with HP to develop 64-bit chips, right? Yeah,
that's when Intel now started to say, we're going to do 64-bit. And as we said in the AMD one, then AMD made theirs cross-compatible. You didn't have to make a chip that's 32-bit and I have to have a chip that's 64-bit. You can actually have one chip that can do both. And then Intel kind of like, didn't think about that though, did we? And then, AMD then. That's also the other marriage that we spoke about, where because AMD used Intel's x86 to make 64-bit, AMD had to give it to them. But they had to license it now from AMD. So hence they are now in licensing harmony. One cannot go without the other one now. So if AMD dies, AMD 64-bit dies, which Intel can't do. Because if that dies, big problem.
These two companies really are joined at the hip, aren't they?
Yes. No, that's... Again, it's kind of to our benefit. It's, I think as far as I know, Bill Gates' original idea was to make sure that... And, even the hard Tesla AMD, you can see there was a lot of people funding the money just to keep them afloat, because they didn't want Intel to be dominant. Because if we now go on from those chips, I don't even know how you would describe it. The litigations that Intel have gone through is just...
Yeah.
I think from what I remember...
They played dirty, right?
Oh, no. Let me put it like this. There has been lawyers that has worked for Intel on one case... And they've worked on that one case so long that they have retired. A lawyer that's on
basically their entire one case working career on,
and they have retired doing one job on one case. That's how long some of those suits are. And again, Intel, you must give them kind of kudos for being such a massive dick to be that aggressive.
What were some of these lawsuits about, though? What were they objecting everything. To?
So it's basically going from basically doing the old thing where you buy a company and then steal the talent beforehand and then buy the company and then somebody will sue you. The big ones we will probably know of and heard will hear of is basically in terms of how they spent money with literally go to companies and say, don't buy AMD. Like, here's a bucket load of cash. Don't buy AMD chips. Even if you lose money, even if we lose money, don't buy AMD. Now, Dell, I would say, is probably the most known one, because I know the Americans went after them quite hardcore on that one. Because at some point, it's stupid. It's like, Intel couldn't afford to buy AMD chips. Because if they did, they would lose money. Even if AMD gave it to them for free. They were so dependent on Intel's rebate system. And this is now where the other big boo-hawk thing comes from. Intel dominated the rebate system. And most companies are copying their rebate system. And it is in my personal opinion, a very dirty trick. Because it's basically going to the company saying, you are contractually abiding to buy X amount of chips per quarter. If you can't sell them, your problem. If you don't next quarter buy more chips for the same amount of quantity, we will cut you in financial size. So you kind of have to buy, let's say you have to buy a million chips a quarter. You have to buy a million. So you have to somehow sell those things. So if you've got AMD coming there trying to give you chips and say, tell us, like, no, the market isn't big enough. We can only sell Intel once because if you don't, we don't make money.
Yeah. And that's that. And it was very often, I mean, Intel was so dominant back in those days that, and of course, Microsoft was so dominant as well. They'd come through the MS-DOS era.
Microsoft did the same.
Microsoft was in a lot of trouble with antitrust authorities.
Bill Gates was not. That was in his ruthless age when he was young and aggressive.
He wasn't a nice guy back then.
Oh, he was a bit. You must give credit there. I would say he was at least a bit more tactical about it. He didn't really do like Intel where they literally just say bribe people. He would literally outsmart the enemy and the enemy would be kind of about it. And then again, you can see them doing a bit of like, you're being a bit misguided and you're like, yeah, you're trying to control the narrative in your specific way because you know if you can control that narrative, they can't do that. So that's why it was difficult for Microsoft to get Microsoft guilty on those cages because they weren't deliberately doing it. It's more like the, here's the carrot and we're not telling you to do it, but I see you with my eye and think, nudge, you can, without saying it.
Yeah.
Whereas Intel literally went, no, like here's our documents, we will screw you over. You see, that kind of Intel was a bit too bullish for that one. And there's still cases going on.
They were investigated for it.
Japan, the European one. I think the European one was still going on. I think they now closed it off now where I think everybody just got tired because that one, the European one that they have there has been sitting in EU law now for close to 25 years.
Good grief.
I'm like, imagine how much Intel has spent on lawyer money for that one case. I'm like, seriously? Like, was it really that worth it? How much? And it's not like, and even I can remember some of the stuff where it's like, even when the American government would like have things against them and so forth, then it's like, oh, you've got the American justice system and they'll have like four lawyers and then it's literally Intel would rock up there with 25 lawyers.
Yeah.
And then it's like, they're coming prepared. Yeah. And because again, some of those lawyers pretty much knew what they did. And it's like, okay, how can we mitigate this so that we don't get, what points can we do to mitigate this so it's not as bad? Or how can we make this thing fail so that they lose this lawyer case? So it's not like, oh, we're innocent. No. How can we make sure that this case dies? Yeah. Which is again, it's like, what? Obviously, it paid off because Intel is still a massive company now. Like, how many trillions are they? Like $71 trillion a year? They're still massive.
Billion, I think. I don't think it'd be trillion.
How much are they worth? Because it's
about $300 billion, I think, is their market cap at the moment. They're just ahead of AMD, which is sitting on about 270.
Yeah, but it's in terms of actual IP, because Intel's IP is worth, like,
Let's have a look at their annual revenue figure. So here we go. 2021 sales of $79 billion, up from $70 billion in 2018. Market cap $295 billion.
Yeah, so they are still worth.
So they're a big company.
They're a massive company. And they've got a crap load of employees. I think there's not a lot of companies. I think it's like
over 100,000.
Microsoft, that type of amount of employees. I don't think there's any other, not even Apple have that amount of employees.
No, Apple's a much smaller company in terms of employees, but not in terms of revenue.
No, we'll get to that on a later episode.
But 121,000 employees as of 2021.
Yeah, that's a lot of people to employ. Jeez, that's like you can almost start your own small little country.
I'm trying to look up an apple in Wikipedia, but it's bringing up a picture of an actual apple.
Oh, joy. Google for the win.
Apple Incorporated. Here we go. Number of employees. So Apple's revenue in 2021 was $366 billion.
Yes.
So that's significantly bigger than Intel.
Yeah.
And their number of employees is 154,000. Are they actually bigger than Intel? 154,000. I didn't realize Apple employed that many people. Yeah.
Oh, well, they do smartwatches. They now do design. I wonder how many actually. Oh, maybe they count all their Apple stores as well, which is a bit cheating.
Oh, yeah. I'm
that's sure maybe cheating a bit.
I'm sure they do.
That's not really fair. It's like how many people.
And their market.
Yeah.
Their market cap. Intel's market cap, 295 billion. Apple's market cap, 2.8 trillion.
No, I don't know. That's that's one thing. I'm like, how can Apple be worth that much? It's like.
10 times as much as Intel. But they're not in the same. They're not really in the same business. Apple's a consumer-facing product.
It's probably software and people piping it up. It's like Tesla. How much worth is Tesla? I'm like, Tesla doesn't have the same amount of IP as even IBM. IBM is worth more money than all of those companies combined, even in my opinion. IBM has way more
IP. Should be.
So, again, it's...
how you use the IP, I suppose.
It's not just... It's how much people think it's valued at. You see, that's the problem.
Yeah.
And like we've learned here now, people don't really know what it's actually worth.
Anyway, let's go back. Yes. We're getting way off track. Let's go back and talk about...
We actually had a nice link there because it's now market caps and all that jazz. Because then we can move on. I don't know if you want to link that stuff. We now lead to market share in terms of CPU shares now. Now that you're going
let's have a look at that. Yeah, let's have a look at that. Do you want to share up that that link of the market share? I mean, it's interesting times because of course we went from the Pentium, then there was a whole series of Pentium processors over a number of years, and then eventually I forget if there were brands after Pentium, but eventually we got to the Core processors about 15 years ago or so. Was there an Intel brand after Pentium? I'm trying to remember.
Well, it's Pentium, and then it was basically the Core architecture. So
it was the Core architecture that came after that.
We would now would start. I think it was first Core, and then basically, I think it was the Q6600s, and then we started with the i series. So i7, i5, blah blah, and onwards. So once they've
So what are we looking at here? Desktop market share. Intel versus AMD, that's very interesting.
So when we look
at when does this start? 2004.
So in the early days of now, we're going Athlon and that type of era when it was highly competitive and so forth. I think the 2006 is probably the peak point of what AMD had with Athlon and so forth. And then it's basically AMD also had Optron then with servers, which also were quite popular with server market. And then Intel did, I think that would probably start with the Haswell architecture there. So
Intel's bouncing up now.
Yeah, now that's now you can see here Intel's manufacturing playing a big part here because Intel also had a massive boon with manufacturing capability. So this is also leading to AMD's problems, and then also this is also where all those nice things happened with Intel where they would ask people not to do their stuff. Again, this is also a bit skewed because most of this would be more enthusiast. I don't know if this counts actual like Dell and HP and so forth, because in those markets Intel is still way ahead of AMD.
Yeah.
So this is
but they've really dominated through the whole Core series of processors.
So you're looking about from the 2006 all the way to about I would say even 2019, most of the dominance set with Intel. With the normal desktop where we would our consumers that are gaming enthusiasts, this is mainly that market, not the OEM market and so forth, because those markets are...
Which is the biggest market. The OEM market must be by far the biggest.
Massive. Laptops, government stuff. AMD is probably like, AMD's probably making some headway in it. I don't know the figures off the top of my head. I would say probably now closer to like maybe 15% now compared to what they were. But on the desktop market, they've jumped considerably compared to where they were. So these are the old bad days when it was Bulldozer and and Intel, AMD was literally on their knees here. In the 2010s, all the way, I would say, probably down to about 2014, they were at their worst, and then it got a bit worse, and then you'll see a start pick up here. That 2017, that's when Ryzen started to show its head.
And I was about to say, is that the Zen architecture coming
that's
in?
Zen, and then you can start seeing it going up, and then 2019, when we start seeing Zen 5, Zen 3 come out, and then you can just start seeing how that architecture just completely dominated with the improvements that they had with the chiplet feature. And then now again, there's some disparity now again, because Intel now has 12 gen. So a bunch of 12 gen have been sold. AMD's probably lost again because Intel has 12 gen. So we'll see how this happens.
So what is that?
End of this year.
What's going to happen to that? What's going to happen to that chart in the next 2 years?
It's probably going to do another like get together again when we get to the end of the year, when we get to AMD Zen 4 and so forth. So we'll probably see, depending on how things go, I think it's going to be much closer now. We're going to see that line become still bouncy, but more in AMD might go up a bit more. So we'll see where it's going to be closer to that 50-50% mark, which is good. AMD, I think, would want to go higher, but I would say your main focus there would be serving. AMD...
And do you think AMD is going to be more successful going forward in the OEM market, or do you think Intel still has that stitched up?
I think depending on how it handles, because OEM market is an interesting market, because especially now that COVID hit, COVID is the thing that kind of threw everyone a bit off game, because most people expected demand to go down because people won't have money, but clearly that wasn't the case. People had a lot of money and they bought a lot. So that's why Intel still makes a lot of money. Even now that we as enthusiasts critique them and say, what a crappy product, they still sell most of what they make. Even though AMD is getting market share, Intel's still selling most of the chips that they're making. So it tells you that because Intel kind of fumbled their manufacturing and couldn't manufacture more chips, because if Intel could manufacture more chips, they would have sold more chips. Because AMD, if AMD wasn't there, we would be in massive trouble, because it would mean Intel would Intel would not be able to keep up. We would have literally like, for 3 months, you wouldn't have Intel chips. Because now that AMD is there, they can take up that slack where Intel now didn't really push their manufacturing. Now AMD can step in and make all those sales, but even then, Intel still sells most of their chips. Which is good for Intel because it means, hey, we're not actually losing as much as we thought they would, because they would have looked way worse if Corona didn't pick up. AMD would have probably been on a much bigger market share now if Corona didn't pick up. But now you've got Intel growing and you've got AMD growing. It's a bit difficult then to say your market share grows with AMD, but the problem is your Intel market share also grows. But it's difficult to measure that, I think, with a lot of these things. And again, that's mostly OEM. Desktop consumer range is a bit more easier to bounce around because the volume you're selling there is less. But if you read Intel's market, their actual their profit slides and shareholder slides and so forth, they're like, it's been a record year. We've sold more than what we did last year, even by them losing market share. Like, how does that happen? Like, by losing, you win.
So, interesting.
Or I would say win, but you still kind of winning, or not like breaking even. I don't know. They're still winning because they're making more money. It just sounds very weird now where we can say that. But it's mainly due to COVID, because when COVID hit, everything sold. If it had a chip in it, it sold. AMD made...
It sold.
AMD had their own little freaking AMD chips that they had were left over. They sold everything. Like, some of the stuff are like, literally AMD sold everything they had. Like, you've got, like, I think some of the suppliers stated to me that they were sold out so fast that even if you placed your order now, you had to wait 3 months for your stock to come. And even Intel was in that position where it's like, it's so bad, logistics there, because now Intel could manufacture enough, but logistics, getting packages and so forth. That's why you'll see a lot of companies start to selling OEM chips, because Intel's like, we don't, the market is so big now and so grabby with chips. We can literally just send them the chips and not even send them the cooler with, and just sell the chip and they'll still take it at the same price.
Yes. Yeah. So yeah, it's been absolutely incredible to see what's happened over the last 2 years and the demand. I see, just as an aside, that the shortage of GPUs seems to be ending at
yes,
last.
No. So, prices are coming so down. We'll get that into part two when we talk about Intel's GPUs and so forth, but everything is getting better now, finally. Like, it's getting better. Finally. It's better, but it's not where it was. We're still recovering and so forth, but it's getting there where we can say, ah, okay, we can now see the light at the end of the tunnel with that type of gas.
Yeah.
So basically, to continue with that type of stuff. So one of the
you are sharing our show notes with the world. You're giving away our secrets. Shout out.
I forgot. I should have shared the other window, not that one.
No, it's cool. You can see how we do the podcast.
No, that's fine. I should have shared another window. So, that's not at the top. Because the thing I wanted to mention now, over those years that Intel were dominant, our biggest problem when Intel was dominant there is we kind of lost the innovation in terms of performance. Because between those years now, when you look at between from now 2007 and 8 and so forth, till basically 2019, just before that, we were stuck with quad cores.
Mm-hmm.
You had now X99 that was server platforms with 6 cores, and they could go up to 8 cores, but they were phenomenally expensive. The big problem was OEMs as well. Like, you had 2 cores with the i5 and the i7s, which were dual cores, which kind of screwed us over. And then, amazingly, as soon as AMD starts being competitive, all of a sudden Intel can, like, all of a sudden there's 6 core processors. Oh, there's 8 core processors. So, all of a sudden Intel can just out somewhere, just, it's like, oh, no, we've got these things.
Fat and lazy.
We've done this. It's like, we were going to launch it. It's like, yeah, but you didn't. So that's kind of my biggest problem with Intel, where Intel,
they got fat and lazy and they didn't innovate.
Yeah, it's
because they didn't have to.
Yeah, you can't say that, but it's like, that's what happens when my biggest gripe with Intel and was in those days is you could see business people taking over. So it's purely business guys where it's like, how can we milk everything? And that's why, like, it's like the Darth Vader thing. You were the chosen one.
Yeah.
Intel, you like Moore, all those guys, you were pushing, and like, and now you've basically done the dark side thing, where you've now done and made sure, kill the competition, kill everything, make sure innovation, you control it, and then drip feed it to people and say, oh, look at this nice, like, freaking new quad core. And they, to Intel's credit, they did pioneer certain things with quad core, where they made the single cores quicker. But in the days we were used to, every year and a bit, we get like an extra 30% or 50% or in the old days, like 100% or 80% quicker. It's like,
it's gone.
Yay, 10%, 5%. Like, come on, man.
I remember through that period, and here's a picture on the screen, by the way, of Intel in that period. I remember back then, I didn't even care what generation core processor I was using anymore.
It's like, I've got a 4th gen. I still have customers coming with 4th gen, only really now upgrading their 6th gen processor. 6th gen. We're talking about almost 8 years ago now. That's bad. Now we're like, now we already have like this chip, AMD 12th gen, and it's AMD Zen this and Intel 12th. Now you can see it's more aggressive, and all of a sudden laptops are changing. So
it's exciting again.
It's exciting. And that's now I'm like, why is it always, and we will talk about that when we get to the NVIDIA one as well. It's only when AMD really starts gunning for it that everyone starts to run. And that grinds my nerdy so much. That they
well done, not for not swearing.
It's like, why? It's like, why does AMD always have to be the guy that does it and not you guys? You guys that have the money, you guys that have the skill. And this also ultimately led to their brain drain. for Intel. Because in those time periods, a lot of guys left and just said, it's boring. Why am I still at this company?
Yeah.
No matter what I do.
And that's one of the reasons they got into trouble, right? Well, I mean, they actually lost key talent. Exactly.
So now that's now what happens there is you start to have that brain tank. And then that now leads to when you're in that period, when you've got stupid amount of money, you could see them starting to lose talent. And then what the marketing or what the CEOs at the top think, it's just, let's buy. So that's what you see now. As I now tell people, it's like, that it was now Intel's Babylon Tower moment, where they just buy everything. Buy that, buy this, buy this AI company, buy this company. We buy them.
And they were buying all weird companies. Like, they bought McAfee.
And it's actually ingenious why they bought them. Like, you can see the actual businessman saying, oh, we buy them so that we force the OEM to put McAfee on there, and then we get the customer to pay a monthly subscription or yearly subscription to McAfee, which we make money from. So you can see why they did that. And it's like malicious as hell.
It's an accountant.
Exactly. You thinking, can see.
Not an engineer. See,
like, don't care about the chip. Like, the chip doesn't matter. The money makes matter. And it's like, even though it's a terrible piece of crap software, like if you can, like the first thing you do with your Intel system, uninstall McAfee, it's a piece of crap. Honestly, me as an IT person that work in a computer store, McAfee is a small little devil. College. It's even worse than Clippy. It's terrible. That thing will make your machine slower. It's just like, no. And they still go with it. Right. I'm like, man, that's... And then you can see all the other companies, like highly good companies. Like, you bought them. What are you going to do with them? And they do nothing. And I'm like, why? You buy all of these nice things. They bought a company that does... That does actually freaking what is the processors now? Let me open that quickly. Well, it's
processors for?
Well, basically, they did a bunch of processors for the same as what Xilinx made. FPGAs. They bought what's the company? Something with an A. They bought them, and we expected them to do all these great things and. They did some nice things, but clearly not good enough for Xilinx to just take it and then just freaking go to the moon. So what is Intel doing with all of these companies? And that's where mismanagement comes in again. They buy all of this.
They have too much money sitting on their balance sheet, and they need it was burning a hole in their pocket.
They're buying all of this talent and then doing nothing with it.
Yeah.
So that was my biggest disappointment with Intel, where it's like you didn't have people in charge to know what you're buying and how to use it properly. And again, this is also to the shareholders, because a lot of the shareholders there are shareholders from Moore's family and their trustees and all those jazz. And they did not. Yeah. They also losing in this, because Intel shares would have been higher now. They've lost a lot of their share in terms of value and all those things, because Intel is now seen as a lesser company now. So it's you kind of screwed yourself over. And the shareholders are... Also, especially the big players are also accountable to that, because they should have seen this and saying, hey, but what the hell's going up with management here? Like, you're making a lot of money here and so forth, but what are we buying and what are we spending it on?
So this, I mean, this really happened. I've just thrown the CEOs. This excludes Bob Swan from 2018 and obviously Pat Gelsinger. So there's two more to that add to that list, but you had these engineers running the company all the way up to Grove. Was Barrett an engineer? I can't remember. I think he wasn't, but certainly under Paul Ottolini and Brian Kranich, a lot of this is when these acquisitions happened, and a lot of the talent left the company.
Paul was the big guy that led the company in the I would say in the dark days when Intel didn't innovate or do anything, and then Brian, he just went with the. I wouldn't even say with... He went with a boat, basically. He didn't do steer it or anything. Yeah. He was just going with it, and you did whatever you wanted. Management did whatever they wanted. And again, that's also where they... A lot of the employees got unhappy with him, especially when Brian was in charge, because they... I'm not joking you, like, retrenched a lot of people and just said, no, we'll just get temp or get temp workers from India and they'll do your job. That we don't have to pay them because they're temps, so we can just fire them whenever we want to make the papers look good when Financial India happens. We can just tank them for a month and then rehire them later.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
that's
accountant speaking.
Yeah, it's not like you being a massive. I'm sorry, that's not nice. You now being really deliberate in how you fudging your money, and not paying people well. Now, when we get to the next episode, we'll talk about how Pat is doing a lot to fix that in a massive panic, but I will give him credit that he is actually taking control of the actual rudder there now and actually pointing the company in a proper position. Because Intel needs to be careful with AMD now.
Yeah.
So I would say I want to I don't know if we can put a link up or something. Well, or you can maybe do that when we do in the description, so forth. Especially from the gent I actually linked in there, because he is a former Intel engineer. What's his thing here? Where is it now?
Is that the video you sent me before the show?
Yeah.
We'll definitely link that up.
Because
we'll
he is an Intel engineer. And he owns a lot of shares as well, because a lot of the Intel share engineers and so forth, because he was one of the pioneers of the core architecture. So the dude, he's a French guy. He knows his stuff. Okay. And that is a great video of how he himself, an Intel guy, nails Intel, like, and not holding back at all. So it's a nice video where people can say, okay, this is a guy within Intel pointing out all the failures of Intel inside.
Yeah, So I wanted to come back to something you mentioned, because we know that Intel fumbled through this period and made some big mistakes. And you mentioned at the beginning of the podcast that one of the areas where they really fumbled was in their manufacturing. What happened there and why? Well, I mean,
that's an interesting story. So basically, due to Intel's kind of just letting it go, so. In that dark times where engineers started to leave because Intel wasn't really pushing, TSMC started to really push, because a lot of the guys bought GPUs from them. So TSMC started to see some very significant growth in GPUs and so forth for high-performance compute.
Yeah.
So when they started to get that, a lot of those Intel engineers left for them and started to help TSMC with their actual products and design and all those things. And you could see a very advanced growth once they got over the 22 nanometer hurdle with TSMC 16, that improved drastically, and then they had another jump. But then also there as well is the time frame when ASML opened up and said, okay, there's Intel, Samsung, and TSMC, you're the three biggest, you now own shares in our company, because you buy most of the lithography machines we make. Here you go. So then what TSMC does, they literally just went and bought all the best machines out of Intel's noses. Because Intel was so high and mighty, and they went just like, oh, aren't Intel buying this? Oh, okay, we'll take them. And they took all the best EUV machines So it's like, Intel
from ASML.
Intel, what the hell, guys? Like, you seriously not going to like buy on that? Like, no. That's why even in the old days, I told people, it's like, why isn't Intel buying? Why is Intel stagnating in manufacturing? Because that is one of their cornerstones. So I tell people, Intel's cornerstones is basically manufacturing, distribution, and then the CPU. So before anything else, the CPU isn't the most important. The most important thing is manufacturing for Intel. And then the second thing is distribution. And then the CPU comes. Mm. The CPU is not that important for Intel anymore, because they are over-reliant on server and over-reliant on mass production for Dell, HP, Lenovo, all these guys. Because a lot of people, just imagine how many Intel chips Intel makes in a month. And they need to, they have to do all the laptops. They have to do all the server, they have to do all the client PCs, all the small form factor machines, and then consumer markets. So they've got five markets that they have to make chips for. And none of them are small. They are in the tens, in hundreds of millions of chips that you need to make. So even to this day, I probably will, in terms of manufacturing output capability, Intel still wins TSMC. TSMC cannot brute force make the amount of chips Intel can. TSMC can maybe make it in the smaller nodes, like in the 22 nanometer and the 30 nanometer and so forth for the cars and so forth. But cutting edge nodes,
mm-hmm.
no one can come close to Intel. Today still. Intel can out-manufacturing mm-hmm. everyone. And even that's what the people's like, you can't expect AMD to rock up and just take a massive amount of market share from Intel. Because Intel just makes more chips than anyone else. At some point, Intel made more x86 chips than ARM combined. That's Samsung, Qualcomm, Apple combined.
Wow.
That's how many chips Intel makes. Because that's what it's like. Imagine that. That's all your cheapy laptops. So all the Celeron laptops, all the i3 laptops, all the i5 laptops, all the i7 laptops. Go see how many laptops there are from Dell. How many laptops are there from Lenovo? How many laptops are there from Dell? And then it's not Asus, Acer, freaking insert name company here. And then you still need to make server chips. And that you make in the hundreds of thousands of chips that you just make server. And then it's the install consumer that you make. Then it doesn't even include IoT or your Nook devices and all those things. So I thought we were like, Intel is humongous. Intel's biggest problem.
How much of a downside is it for AMD that it relies on other fabrication facilities? Well, and how much of an advantage is it that Intel has its own?
It's one of those things where it's like, AMD was smart where they knew they shouldn't try beat Intel where Intel is the best at. Intel is good at making a lot of chips. So Intel knew, okay, how do we beat them? We need to make a niche product that they cannot compete with.
Mm.
So that's why they made, like, and that's why, again, AMD, like, you can look at their records, the amount of chips, AMD sells everything. Like, anything they take and manufacture, they've sold. So they if AMD could buy more capacity, they could. This is why later on, TSMC is now making more capacity for them. And AMD is becoming a competitor to Apple now in terms of how much capacity they take. Because Apple normally takes majority of the share. But Apple's market is basically hitting a cap, I think. Whereas AMD's one is growing and will ever grow. Because it's server and it's high profit margins. So there's a good point with AMD because it makes it easy and flexible to change stuff. With Intel, because you have such a massive market, it's difficult for them to change direction. Because if you have a massive, let's say you make a chip, you need to make that chip work with a lot of different things. You can't just make a chip to do one thing. Because you have IoT to worry about. You've got server to worry about. You have client, desktop, and laptop. That's why for most of Intel's history, your laptop chips were majority the same as the desktop ones. Like literally using the same chip. They don't do that anymore now because things have changed now, but that was also very advantageous to them where you can sell your desktop chip in a laptop and made it just a bit more power efficient and there you go. You can sell it like that. So for Intel, because you're so big, it does limit you in that regard, but it also makes it, now because you're so big, it's so easy for you to make more money because Dell can rock up to Intel and say, okay, we need 5 million chips. And Intel says, sweet, when do you need it by? We can have it in 3 weeks. AMD can't do that. There is no company that can do that from what I understand. Maybe when you get to Samsung with memory and so forth, but for complex CPUs and GPUs, this will now lead to our episode 2 with where Intel can actually now, they need to start, their manufacturing needs to update. And now Intel's also spent a stupid amount of money getting the new stuff from ASML so that they can start keeping up and so forth. But it's now, because they're such a big company, it's difficult for them. For TSMC, it's much easier because they don't have as many factories. Yeah. So it's much easier for them to get a new EUV machine, put it in, start manufacturing. They have a smaller client base, so there we go. Intel can't do that. They can't just have 2 EUV machines. They can't. They make too many chips. They need to have at least 12 EUV machines for them to fully go for it. So that was also the kind of where you could say management fail, but it's also because you're not so big, you can't just buy 2 or 3. When you go, you have to go big. And that's one of those machines is what, $200,000-$300,000 or $1 million per machine?
Or more.
Yeah, I think it's like 200 $200 million per machine. Per machine. You don't just buy one.
Yeah.
One factory takes like at least like, I think it's like 12 of them.
ASML.
Then you haven't bought the people to, then you don't have the engineers to run the thing yet. You've just bought the machine. You still need to have the factory and all the things that come with it. So the factory alone, they think, Intel spending like stupid $60 billion and so forth for fabs and so forth. And I think they're only making like, I think it's like, how many fabs are they making? I think it's like 10.
I forget the number, but it's about $20 billion they're spending.
I think in total, now with the CHIPS Act that I think with the new administrative there in America did now, I think it's 11 fabs that they're building in America now.
Wow.
I think it's 11 in America, it's 7 in Europe, and it's 15 in Asia. Now, I mean Asia Pacific in terms of, Japan, Korea, and then in Taiwan. So they even upping their, but they have the most, again, that's now going with, like, you've got the Samsung guys there, you've got Hynix there, so there's a lot of guys there as well, and then you've got Toshiba there as well. So there's a lot of companies there still in Asia that make stuff that not necessarily is chips, but they still need fab factories for those.
Still a big and important company, and it's clear that Pat Gelsinger is not flogging a dead horse here. There's still a lot of potential inside Intel.
I think he was quite honest when he told people straight, like, we're not going to make profit for the next couple of years. Like, we're spending every penny we have, because if we don't, we will basically, the company will collapse in itself.
Yeah. Which is what the opposite of what they were doing for so many years, especially through the 2010s.
Now, again, I must say, they're playing much nicer now. They've not really come up to the old tricks like they did in the old days, where they would force people not to buy their stuff. But at least now they're more, way more honorable. And again, they're actually making good products. 12th gen is fairly decent. Well,
they've got an engineer running the show again.
Yeah, that helps. Again, it's difficult because the problem with most of those things as well, and I think Intel also fell to this trap, is you need to think 5 to almost 10 years ahead of time. So whatever you do now, like, you're already working on stuff that you will launch in the future. And that was also maybe one of the biggest fall points, is because they kind of got complacent and then kind of didn't really, like, focus on the future. That bites you hard. Like, that's why Intel, for a long time now, will lose and continue losing for a bit before they'll actually start becoming good again. Because you can't, it takes 5 years to make something up again. So you can't just, like, on a dime, like most industries, like Apple and like Google, I'll just do this thing in a couple of months. It's like, no, you're out of the game for like 3 years, my dude. Sorry. You'll have to now, next time I can, then you can try again. So that's the big problems with those things, is you have to have a lot of smart people knowing beforehand what to do, how to make, will it plan out, and then you can have it. So
a lot to talk about in episode 2 of Intel. We're going to unpack some really interesting topics. We're going to look at Intel's decision to venture into the graphics market, the GPU market, with Arc. That's their brand. We're going to have a look at why they're doing that. We're also going to have a look at their latest processors. We're going to unpack in a little bit more detail their 12th gen processors and what they've perhaps done differently with the 12th gen core processors compared to previous generations. And also a look ahead at what's coming in the 13th generation Intel core chips. Quite looking forward to hearing more about that, because I've done no reading on Intel 13th gen. Them reinventing themselves and becoming a contract chip manufacturer, which is a new thing for Intel. Interesting stuff to unpack there. And of course, we'll look at ARM, TSMC, and Apple Silicon, and whether those are really going to pose a threat to Intel going forward. And of course, underlying all of this is the big question, and that's can Pat Gelsinger actually turn this ship around?
Yep.
So lots to talk about next week. And thanks for, as always, for joining the show. If you've got any feedback for us, we'd love to hear from you. I still haven't set up that joint email address yet, Gerard, but I will get around to it at some point soon. In the meantime, you are most welcome to email both of us. You can mail me at duncan@techcentral.co.za. Gerard, what's your email address again?
GerardP@computersonly.co.za.
Computers Only, and the Computers Only store is in Midrand. Yeah. If you want to go visit Gerard, he does a great job of building custom PCs, and highly recommend him. So go check out Computers Only. As always, thanks for tuning in, and look forward to unpacking more on Intel in part 2, episode 4 next week. And what are we doing after Intel? I think we've got Nvidia on our list, don't we?
The big green goblin.
Next discussion. The Green Goblin. You're not a fan, are you?
Well, I tell it, there's a lot of great stuff with them, but yeah, they are very Green Goblin. So there's goblins doesn't mean they're bad, but we'll get into that when we get to that one, because there's a lot of two stuff to unpack with NVIDIA.
Absolutely. Great. Well, stick around. Next week, we'll unpack the rest of the Intel story and lots more to discuss on everything PC. And we'd love to get your feedback. So do mail us, duncan@techcentral.co.za or gerardp@computersonly.co.za. Until next time, happy computing.
Cheers.